ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Australia's alliance with the United States has been the linchpin of our country's foreign policy for decades.
We value the unbroken friendship between the Australian and the American peoples.
But between the wars and the tariffs and the unpredictability, are we growing apart?
You know who else didn't help us? Australia.
Join me, Hamish McDonald.
And me, Geraldine Doogue, as we ask, do we still need the alliance? Search for Global Roaming on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
China Shock 2.0 has begun. But while China Shock 1 saw cheap goods flood the world, this time it's very different, and the consequences could run far deeper. That's because it's all about cutting-edge technology and AI. Today, David Otter, the economist who helped coin the phrase China Shock, one of Time magazine's most influential people of 2026, on whether nations, including Australia, are ready for it. I'm Sam Hawley on Gadigal Land in Sydney. This is ABC News Daily. David, you and your co-researchers coined the phrase China Shock. Tell me about how that came about, because it was a term taken up around the world.
Yeah, it referred to the very dramatic rise of China as a world manufacturing power. And that led to, in the United States, a flood of low-cost imports. That was good for consumers, lowered prices, but it decimated import-competing sectors in the United States. And unfortunately, workers did not quickly find new employment in other manufacturing or outside of manufacturing. Instead, we saw that translate into unemployment, to non-employment, to public benefits receipt, and then to other forms of social malaise, including reduced fertility, reduced marriage, more children growing up in poverty, and even what some have called deaths of despair.
So, David, we're going to unpack with you what is now being dubbed China Shock 2.0. But yeah, it's good to step back to understand what was going on in the 2000s during that initial shock. It was sharp and it was painful, and it wasn't just an economic realignment, was it?
No, it was a huge displacement, and it left scars. Mm. And it could have been done a lot better. And I think, you know, hopefully we now understand that just letting it rip at all times without any regard to the type of adjustment that it implies or the sectors we might lose is probably unwise.
And this was because cheap Chinese manufactured goods were flooding the American market, and many blue-collar workers in the United States lost their jobs because of that.
Absolutely. Now, let me say, these were not strategic industries. These were, you know, textiles, furniture, dolls, electronic assembly. It was consequential because it wiped out communities that were based around these industries. And, you know, some of this, you know, China was a low cost, a highly productive manufacturer of many of these things. So it's natural that there would be rebalancing of trade. It just happened very quickly. Mm. The policy just kind of pulled the cork off. There's evidence that there was some currency manipulation by China that made this go even faster. And China's market didn't reciprocally open. So U.S. manufacturers didn't really find an equally receptive trading partner in China.
And I mean, millions of Americans lost their jobs.
It's important to understand, you know, the U.S. labor market at that time had 150 million workers. Mm-hmm. So a couple million workers is not that large as a share of the labor market, but there's extremely geographically concentrated in the South and the South Atlantic, in specific counties that were, you know, the furniture capital of America, the sweatshirt capital of America. So these were the anchor industries of those communities. If it was a couple million jobs distributed across the 3,000 plus counties in the United States, it wouldn't have been that noticeable. But because it was so concentrated, and that's because manufacturing is concentrated, and not just manufacturing, specific industries within manufacturing are in specific places, that it was extremely disruptive.
And from what you're saying, America was not ready for this shock, for this influx of Chinese goods.
Not in the least bit. It was not ready for the labor market adjustment that that implied.
Yes.
I mean, it was for consumers got lower prices. It's not that there was no upside to this. The benefits were very diffuse. Lots of people got lower prices at Walmart and Target and so on, and the costs were extremely concentrated.
And good to point out that it was devastating for American workers, but in Australia, well, it sort of turned into a boom for us because
sure.
China needed our resources, right, like iron ore. And again, consumers here got these cheaper goods.
Absolutely. And you know, China's growth, you know, not only did it bring hundreds of millions of Chinese out of poverty, but it created resource booms around the world that created, you know, prosperity in Central and South America and Sub-Saharan Africa, in Australia, as you note. Now, of course, many of the countries that felt themselves to be beneficiaries of this in the early 2000s are now very much feeling the brunt of it now, feeling the pressure as Chinese trade has changed enormously.
Right. So, David, let's now turn to China Shock 2.0. Tell me, are you certain that that is now underway? And when did it begin?
Oh, it's absolutely underway. Mm-hmm. And when did it begin? You know, it's been building momentum since, you know, a couple years after COVID, when China came into its own as a frontier manufacturer of solar cells, windmills, steel, aluminum. Increasingly, you know, at that time, now the world's premier producer of electric vehicles, of batteries, of drones, of ships, of port cranes, telecommunications equipment, you know, mobile phones, and now artificial intelligence as well. China is really at the frontier of many, many of these sectors, which, you know, they deserve a lot of credit for. This was done very strategically with an enormous amount of state investment, and at this point is really unbalanced. China's trade surplus is about 1% of world GDP, which is just unheard of. And there, you know, many people think that China's currency is massively undervalued. And so that makes its exports incredibly cheap for the rest of the world and makes imports for China quite expensive. And so this creates a situation where a lot of the industrialized economies, manufacturing industries are now under severe strain because they simply can't compete at those prices. Now, again, you could say, well, look, they're getting all these things so cheaply, and that's true. But in the long run, I think most industrialized economies have an interest in maintaining their transportation sectors, their motor vehicles, aircraft, electronics. They're critical not just for employment, but for national security. And also for innovation.
Okay, so as this second shock gathers steam, what do you think we should expect? Will it be worse than the first shock?
It is in many ways worse than the first shock, because the first shock was primarily about jobs, which are a very unfortunate thing to lose. But this one is much more about control of critical sectors that affect domestic profits, innovation, military security, privacy, cybersecurity, and even have implications for soft power around the world. So we could, from a domestic security point of view, we could afford to lose textiles and footwear and commodity furniture. I think the U.S., if it were to lose its domestic auto industry, that would be very problematic. If it were to lose, you know, its major aircraft manufacturer, Boeing, that would be extremely problematic. If it lost, you know, frontier capability in advanced semiconductors and artificial intelligence chips, that would be a very serious problem. And already, many interdependencies between China and the rest of the world have been weaponized, most particularly rare earth metals.
What do you mean by that?
Well, when Trump, too, started his tariffs on China, China recognized it had a choke point. It mines more than 90% of all the world's rare earth metals and sells them. And those things are necessary for batteries, for electric engines, for military equipment, for semiconductors. And so they're kind of a lifeline of most frontier industries. And China has put them on a very short leash and made it abundantly clear that actions that it views as hostile, whether they are diplomacy with Taiwan or tariffs or even investigations of its company, will be met by choking off that supply. And that's a big artery to step on.
Yes, absolutely. A powerful position that the Chinese are in.
Absolutely.
So, David, America was arguably the biggest loser from the first China shock. As we said, Australia was somewhat of a winner. What about this time? Who are the biggest losers going to be?
I would say Western Europe, right? So, you know, Germany, Italy, France. But I also think Australia. My perception is that China has been, you know, using its buying power or withdrawing its buying power as a means of punishment, even pulling back all of its students. Japan is also being in various ways buffered or battered by China for its diplomatic support of Taiwan. So I think ultimately many, many industrialized countries that are, especially those that are, you know, intensive in manufacturing, are going to lose a lot.
And what, many millions of jobs will go? Is that the prediction there?
Yeah, jobs. I mean, again, I'm a labor economist, so I think of the world in terms of jobs. So I'm the last person who wants to tell you that jobs are not the most important thing. But in this case, you should be thinking about jobs alongside issues of innovation, national security, and, you know, even leadership in terms of, you know, it matters who sets the standards in smartphones and electronics and 5G networks or 6G networks, you know, the next generation.
Well, David, why don't we consider that a bit further, what nations can do to counter this second China shock, which you say is, of course, already underway. Now, the US and Europe, they are already putting these tariffs in place. But does that actually help in the long run?
Yeah. So, I mean, there's an irony that because the U.S. has introduced so many of its own protections, China has doubled down on exporting to Europe and the rest of the world, right? So, in fact, Europe has inherited some of the United States' problem. And so China's, you know, again, to its credit, has very flexibly found its way into new markets. Tariffs are generally not a great long-term solution. Again, I want to be clear. There's much to admire about what China does. China plays a long game very effectively in a way that I wish the United States did and other countries. It invests, it looks ahead to what its vulnerabilities and what its assets will be and plans accordingly. And China is extremely innovative, hardworking, and productive. So I don't want to say that all these things occurred because China was cheating. That's not the case. However, China simultaneously doesn't play by the rules in terms of the extent of subsidy, the extent of market protection, and the extent of essentially obtaining the intellectual property of its trading partners forcibly. And so at this point, Exhibit A at this point is China's outrageous trade surplus. And that is something that the rest of the world should be acting forcibly about. But it would take a coalition of many countries. And unfortunately, the United States has, you know, done its best to alienate its friends and court its enemies during the second Trump administration. And so, you know, Europe really needs to act forcefully to protect its domestic industries, in my opinion, but it really needs the United States to back it. And I'm sure it's saying, wow, no one's got my back here. Like, maybe I should just cut a deal. No country is large enough to stand up to China on its own and economically and really force China to reconsider some of its policies. And in the interim, I do think it's just cutting off imports or dramatically reducing imports of some Chinese goods would be appropriate. The United States has a 100% tariff on Chinese EVs. Now, I don't think that's viable for the long run, but I think it would be reasonable for some years while the U.S. industry retooled. Unfortunately, the Trump administration has simultaneously undercut all progress in EVs in the United States and doubled down on internal combustion engines, you know, vehicles that no one will be driving a decade from now. So the U.S. is going the opposite of back to the future.
Yes, exactly.
It's turned around and it's heading at, you know, accelerating pace into the past.
Oh, gosh. All right. Well, David, just leave me with a final thought, though. How long can we expect this next shock, this China shock 2.0, to last? And then will it have a long-lasting impact on the entire world?
I think we can expect it to last until the world gets its act together to convince China to change what it's doing. It will have a very significant enduring impact, because once you lose frontier sectors, it's very, very rare to get them back. And it will also change the military balance of power along with the kind of economic balance of power. So yeah, I think, you know, we are seeing the changing of the guard in terms of the leading powers of the 21st century.
David Otter is a labor economist, professor of economics, and the head of the MIT Department of Economics. This episode was produced by Ilaria Brophy and Louise Mylan. Audio production by Sam Dunn. Our supervising producer is Sydney Pete. I'm Sam Hawley. Thanks for listening.